Okay, I'm just going to bring us into a new track. So this is track 2, December 4th, 2021, and Talking with Dad, Dave Disler. And we have been through, it's around the holiday times for us, so we've been through some memories of just those, you know, those tastes and those sights and the sounds kind of the holidays, and also some of the early childhood environments too, from Shelbyville to, and that would be new, it's not New Whiteland, it was Whiteland.
New Whiteland.
New Whiteland.
Yeah.
So kind of bringing us back there, we talked a bit about Dan Weber too, and go back into that early, you know, you went to school then in Whiteland, you stayed in the Whiteland school system like the whole time, right?
Yes.
What kind of, just in your impression, what were you like as a learner or as a kid? You said you were kind of an explorer, like going out on your bike. What happened when you went to school, or what was that like for you? What was that experience like?
I always got really good grades, but I never really had to work too hard at it. Never really brought a book home. Learned pretty quick, and got bored a lot in class, but the school itself was kind of a rural school, so it wasn't a lot of college prep courses. There were some, but there wasn't in the Whiteland school system, it wasn't super challenging. I got decent SAT scores and everything, but I enjoyed it. I just didn't have to work at it very hard. It just came pretty easy to me.
How did you, being in that kind of environment, what did you do with your boredom?
Well, I was in a band. I played a musical instrument, and I had a lot of band friends as I got older. And then when I was younger, I would be as creative as I could, making things or working on things out in the garage or... you know, working with my hands, doing something.
Do you feel like you were kind of like a tinkerer then?
Yeah.
Were you always like having your hands on something and just kind of exploring that?
I'd always try to make things better. If it was broken, I always try to fix it. I could take things apart and usually put them back together and make them work.
When did you know that you could do that? Or do you remember giving that a try when you were a kid? And you're like, oh, I can just do it.
I remember just... saying, oh, I can do that, and I just did it.
Oh, so would you consider that kind of like a gift?
Yes.
Do you remember the first things that you, like, took apart or tried to put together?
Yeah, there was like a wind-up alarm clock, there was an old electric train, there was an old radio that I had put together out in the garage. I did microphones, I did all sorts of things like that. I got a lawnmower that was broken that never ran from a science teacher when I was in seventh grade, and I said, I can fix that and make it run. And so a week later, I brought it back to the classroom, pulled the rope, and started it up for her.
What did they think about that?
Well, they were impressed. They didn't think I could do it.
How did you feel about being able to do that?
I felt it was easy. And but no one asked how, you know, well, how'd you do that? How'd you figure that out? No one seemed like they were as interested in it as I was. To them, making the thing run, they probably didn't even know it didn't run in the first place. So it was more of interest to me than it was to class. I remember that.
Yeah. Do you remember, as that being like a gift, do you remember the first time that you realized you could do that, or is that just inherent in you?
Like, it's inherent. There wasn't any particular time. Well, I think I've always been able to do stuff like that to some extent.
Did you feel like other people noticed you for being able to do stuff like that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think my parents had that feeling, yes.
Did either of them have that trait?
No.
Where do you think you got that?
From my grandfather, my mother's father.
Okay. So what do you know? I'm wondering, did you ever ask that question like, where did this come from, or how do I know how to do this?
They would tell me that I'm just like Opa. I could take anything apart and put it back together and make it work.
So what did that mean? Did you receive some stories from him? Like, or did your parents tell you things about
stories,
Opa?
Yeah.
What do you remember learning about him?
To supplement his electricity at his house in Unterprunlis in Czechoslovakia, he went out and he was an electrician for a glass factory. He built a water wheel power generator, water turbine, and that supplied 220 volts to the household, because their electricity wasn't all that reliable. So they electrified part of the house with the water wheel that was built down on the stream there in that small village.
And their house was pretty close to the stream, or the the little stream going through had enough water to create some electrical. It doesn't sound like it ran dry.
No, it came down from the mountains and it flowed very fast. It was probably about 15 or 20 feet across, fairly deep, and it ran very fast. It was a mountain stream. It had velocity to it for sure. You couldn't swim across it. I mean, if you tried, you would be taken down.
Okay.
Taken down the hill. So.
In your, there's two things I'm really interested in. One of them, you as an adult had visited. Did you visit that area?
No.
What was the environment like? What were the mountains? You know, like the Smokies, were they like hills? What was that area? What do you remember about that area? What did it look like?
I told my mother that it reminded me of the Sound of Music.
Hmm.
So some of the scenes in the Sound of Music where you'd have not white-capped mountains, but big hills, big rolling hills, like you'd see in some of the scenes in Sound of Music. So it was very, very hilly. More so than what I would say the Appalachians are in the United States, but they were green hills. They weren't desert. They weren't like mountains. They were just big hollers, you know, like you find down in Virginia and West Virginia. West Virginia is probably the closest in the United States that I could point toward as being. The Erzgebirge Mountains, which was the...
Yeah, spell the mountains again.
Erzgebirge, it's Erzgebirge, E-R-D-G-E-B-E-R-G-E, or B-E-R-G, I believe, is how it's spelled. And it's the border mountains between Germany and Bohemia, or Czechoslovakia. It's a natural boundary between the two places.
Mm-hmm. And they were in the side of Bohemia.
Right.
On that. And Bohemia, that while they were there, that place was called Sudetenland.
It's called Sudetenland. It was also called Bohemia, the King of Bohemia. I think when it became more, when they started importing German workers to work the mines, because it was a mining area, they pulled in thousands of people from Germany. That's what created Sudetenland. And a lot of the people that lived there kept the German language. That was in the 1870s, 1880s, when the big German migration started, when they were opening up all these mines over there.
So they would call them German Sudanese?
No, they would call them Sudetenland.
Germans? Sudeten German.
The Germans would call it that.
Okay, and they were, so that's interesting. So they primarily, a lot of them came into the area for work, for mining work.
Mm-hmm. Coal mining, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in like another thing, so it does mirror a bit of what, like West Virginia is a big coal place,
right,
too, a big mining place. So they did, from what you know in that area, that was, they were mining in, do you know when they started mining out that? What, in the 18?
In the 1800s, I would say about the middle of the 1800s, is when the mining operations really started getting underway.
Mm-hmm. And that's when the population kind of like fluxed. Do you know what brought your family to that area?
Wish I did. Their name was Kohler, which is the name for coal. And there was a large region over there that was, of course, where where they mined coal. So it could have been that family was over there for a really, really long time. But the Kohler family, K-O-H-L-E-R, goes back into Germany many centuries. So in southern Germany. So I don't know when, I have not been able to find when they went into the Sudetenland area by Königsberg. That's still left to be discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the only time you had visited there as an adult, was there anything else when you went into that area, just being a part of your ancestry? And definitely it sounds like you have a connection somehow to you've inherited at least something from your grandfather, your opa, in the way that he had an ability, it sounds like, of almost mechanical ability, or being able to see things and just know how they work, or taking them apart and putting them together. When you were visiting over there, did anything else just like seem to make sense for you or resonate with you once you saw the land, or was there anything surprising about being there and what you saw?
The age of things, of course, when I went over there, it was kind of it was just coming out of the Dark Ages, because they were behind the Iron Curtain, so very, very poor when I saw them. This was probably 1990. The Berlin Wall had just fallen, 1990 or 91, when I was over there. And they were just coming out of poverty, Soviet poverty imposed upon them. And I think the thing that wasn't their heritage, but that's the thing that impressed me the most, is they're kind of living in the Dark Ages. See, they're living back, let's say it was 1990. I would say that they were living like everything was 1965, as far as things being modern or lack of being modern. And, there's horse carts, and then people would see a car from, out of the country. They weren't used to seeing that, and they'd stare at it, especially if it was like a Mercedes or something. So when I went back there, it wasn't really a fair assessment. Now, Czechoslovakia is totally different. But when I was there, the poverty is what really struck me.
Mm. Yeah. Did you, was there anything left over, you think, of from when your family was there, or had it all been almost demolished?
Wiped off the map, except for the house that mom was born in, which is more of a lean-to type of thing on the back of a factory. And then up the hill a little bit, there was a smaller, like I called a cottage, up the hill. But Unterprunlis had only about half of the number of buildings standing. The house that my mother lived in, my opa lived in, was just kind of it looked like a lean-to. It was bigger than a lean-to, but it was just attached to this big wall, big block stone wall on the back of what was then, when I went back there, a toy factory. And how it was built or what the history was, I have no idea, or how he got it. It must have been...
Is that where they live?
That's where they live. And he must have gotten that because of some sort of relationship to the factory. The factory may have owned that. The glass factory may have owned that toy factory and had a residence. And, of course, they helped him find that place. I don't know that story, but very modest upbringing.
Yeah, it seems like that. I wonder if that theme kind of ran through with your grandfather, because if I remember the story, he was also a boarder for a while.
Yeah.
That's how he met his, well, what would become your grandmother.
Right.
So, he seems, and then eventually, so then they lived in kind of like a more lean-to, I mean, modest. And then when they were deported, they ended up living in a gymnasium for a while. And then the,
Fanatic.
yeah, then that, the minister's quarters, which was just on the side of the church quarters. So it seems like they hardly ever really had a, like he almost didn't ever really have a place that was.
He had very little. Of course, they had what, four kids?
Yeah.
So they didn't have a lot of wealth. My grandmother never worked. I think she worked for the Keno a little bit in Seeheim. But generally speaking, that was years after they left Czechoslovakia. But I don't think she ever worked, and there was four kids to feed, and I think Opa was just barely struggling to put enough money on the food on the table. I think they, as far as possessions go, I don't even know if they owned that house or they rented that house. It's kind of hard for me to say. My guess is they didn't own it, they rented it.
Yeah. What do you remember of Opa as a, did you, you met him, but you didn't spend a lot of time with him because you were, he was back in Seeheim, right? And what do you remember of him from your point of view as a kid?
Well, 1961, 1965 would be the only 2 years and 2 weeks that I would have spent around him. Very stoic, quiet, and reserved. And seemed to be very, stoic is probably the best word for it. Didn't have much to say. He kind of kept to himself. He was around the family, but he was a very quiet person. A little bit like me. I can get very quiet too, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you resonate with a certain kind of stoicism
Yeah.
of, and has that for you? Has that been true for you kind of through time? Like, or do you resonate with Stoicism as a way, but it's also kind of a philosophy too, right?
It is. It's a, it's a desire not to be the center of attention, but to be kind of like part of a group, or just observe, or just alone with your own thoughts a lot of times, and not have to have somebody around all the time. Not dependent upon other people as much as some people are. Very independent minded, and I think that's the way my opa was.
Yeah. Do you yeah, that's interesting. So you had just a very little contact with him, but do you have a sense, do you feel in your adult life now, do you still feel, do you feel a connection with him somehow?
I feel I have his personality traits, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have, as far as knowing yourself and, you've done a lot of work genealogically, so you do have the stories, you've done a lot of like generational mechanics. Would you say, do you feel, do you have any relatives that you feel like you've also inherited like, either traits or philosophies from? Is there others that feel kind of strongly running through you, or does he have a, more prominent kind of
Well,
feature?
the others beyond my grandparents, I never knew much about any of my grandfathers in the United States, any of his family, nor did I know much about my grandmother's family, because they were from Ohio and they were long gone a lot of time, by the time I was able to recognize. I met my grandfather's mother one time before she died. That was in Louisville, Ohio, like 1958, something like that. But anyway, not knowing any of their personalities, I've done some research and I knew what they did for a living. And I've heard a little bit of stories about them from, from dad. I don't feel that way about anybody in the United States that I have a connection with.
Mm.
And it might just be that either I haven't heard all the stories or I just don't recognize a connection. I'm not like my grandfather over here, I know that.
Well, yeah, tell me about what do you know of your grand... This would be your grandfather, meaning...
Dad's dad.
Dad's dad. And this would be a Francis Charles? No, that's...
Yes, that's correct.
Francis Charles, yep.
He worked all... he was all about
the
work.
The railroad guy, yeah?
Yeah, he was all about work, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he kind of cut ties with his family in Louisville when he moved from Louisville to Middletown, Ohio. Once he left, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
He seemed, you know, he talked to his mother and father, and he'd go back there every year or two, I guess, to visit them, but it was not very, it wasn't a big desire for him to go back there. He loved to fish and mm-hmm. hunt. I don't like to hunt, but I do like to fish. That's the only thing I may have gotten from him. Mm-hmm. We would go to Salina, Ohio, and fish at Lake St. Mary's.
Mm-hmm.
You'd go to a very inexpensive cottage over there on the dam on the west side of the lake, and we'd fish. He'd love to do that. But Grandpa never really gave himself enough time to really spend time with his grandkids or even with his own kids because he was working so often.
What do you think caused him to be so much into his work like that?
Well, that generation, he was born in, 05, and went through the Depression right when he was trying to earn a living and lost a car during the Depression. Everything had to be, everything revolved. He worked for the railroad for 44 years and always worked in the railroad industry. And so he... I think he just grew up with the mentality that, you know, it's all about your job, you know, putting food on the table.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he looked at, and everything else was pretty far down the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that also it makes sense that do you feel that kind of was... a line that went through your father's
yeah.
line. So you had a grandfather who was in the Depression and kind of, and then had the son, you know, you're the son of a Depression era, like grandfather, right?
Right.
Grandfather. So do you feel like that work ethic, like that sort of thing was like channeled through your father line in that way?
Yeah, it was. And I had that for a long time myself, I think, until, I don't know, probably when I was about 45 or 40 years old.
Mm-hmm. What do you think happened then?
I just saw that the loyalty that come at that time, the loyalty that companies gave their employees was waning, and vice versa. You know, employees weren't giving the company a lot of loyalty. And so when I was about 45 was when that was all changing. And so people didn't have their 40-year jobs anymore. They'd go out and find another job that paid a little bit more, and you just didn't have the connection to your employer that my father did, and his father, and Ellen's, you know, father.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a different era, and I was in the era where all that changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and work is very different, as you know, now.
It's even more different now.
For generations, it's... Mm-hmm. How did you end up navigating? Talk about work, then, coming from that kind of... You know, the line that you came from, you know, in the generation that you came from, and being the oldest, you know, son of a line in that way, what did you make of work and like life? Oh, we can call it like vocation, life, purpose, work. Like, how did that change for you over time? Were you motivated to be a worker? Was it something that you were like, oh, I have to do this? Or is it something that's always been a question for you?
No, I wanted to work, and I got into electronics and got into management fairly quick. I was a very good electronics technician and got involved into sales engineering from there, helping customers technically on the phone, and then sales itself, where I do world travel. And I was really big into that all the way through probably, let's see, I'm gonna say it's the early 2000s. And one of the things that kind of changed for me is that travel after 9/11 in 2001 was horrible. It was horrible to travel for a couple, 3 years right after that because of all the security. Domestic flights, you have to arrive an hour and a half, 2 hours before the flight would take off. And the plane seats got smaller and smaller, and you used to be able to get on an airplane just like you'd walk on a bus, or a train, but not anymore. So it became such a drudge that I lost interest in doing world travel for business. And that took more out of me than I think about anything. Plus the loyalty that I saw that the companies were giving certain people, or the lack of it. In my group of people, plus the opening up of China was a horrible blow to the U.S. electronics industry because everything got shipped over there. Beyond Japan, just think about China. If you think Japan was bad for U.S. electronics, China was 10, 20 times worse. Because there was more people, and they could produce things super cheap, and so greedy employers over here started shipping all their stuff, chasing cheap labor across the planet, and factories were being shut down, and products were being copied overseas, and those companies were out of business, and they just made a big mess of things. Right after the 2000s, I think that's when it changed for me about, wake up and smell the roses. Work is not your be all. Also, when I had my cancer treatments in 2001, that changed me
I
fundamentally.
was going to ask, how old were you? Yeah, talk about how old were you when that happened and talk. Yeah, that changed things, huh?
Yeah, let's see. I would have been, let's see, 40, 45, 46 years old was when I was diagnosed with a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I had all those weeks of chemo and radiation. And that whole process right there, when you're faced with your own mortality and things like that. I mean, I caught the cancer early, but I still had to go through all the pain of the treatments and recovery. I can even remember my company wondering when I was going to be able to travel as much. They asked me that probably about a year after I'd got all my treatments, and the guy I was reporting to said, "Well, when are you going to be able to get back on the road like you used to?" So that kind of stuff hit me wrong, and just kind of reminded me that, boy, you're just a wood chopper. They just want you back on the road. They don't really care. I don't remember my employer at the time being super, super concerned about my treatments, even though I barely missed any time because I had a remote office. So that whole thing all combined made me think, you know what? A job doesn't make the man. And that's just what I felt.
Yeah, what was that like for you when you were facing going through cancer and the treatment and all of that? Do you feel, we were talking about like stoicism earlier, did any of that come through, or was that a time that were you, I mean, was that a stoic time? How was that for you? How did you feel about that?
Well, most of the people didn't want to know a lot of the details. In other words, they didn't want to talk about, they couldn't handle the details, or they just weren't interested, or it made them uncomfortable, you know, hearing all the details you're going through. So you're pretty much in it for by yourself. There were some people that would avoid you, almost treat you like you were contagious. But really what it turned out to be is they just didn't want to be around what they considered to be negative influencers. And so they would just avoid having to, well, what am I going to say to Dave? He's going through all this chemo, he's losing his hair, and he can barely walk up steps and things like that. So a lot of people just kind of stepped away. Other people didn't. Other people came in and were very concerned. It was kind of a mixture of a surprise on either end. You know, some people were really, that I didn't expect to be concerned, really were concerned, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Who did you find stepping away?
Employer. Some of my acquaintances over the years that I worked with. You know, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it sounds like that process, do you ever, and maybe this is, some people don't ask things like this, but did you ever ask yourself, huh, where is this coming from?
What's that about? People told me where it was coming from. They would say, when you would sit there in the waiting room waiting to get, you'd have conversation with people there, and they'd say, well, you'll know who your friends are for sure during this whole thing. And I'd ask them what they meant by that, and they would tell me pretty much what I said. Some people are very superficial, or they don't want to be around somebody because they don't like to be around somebody who's sick, or they don't have really anything to say. They can't be compassionate. You know, they don't know how to be compassionate with others, so they just avoid the situation.
What do you feel about just you as a personality? Do you feel that you are, do you feel like you are empathic, or what's your relationship with compassion? Like, how are you with people and their suffering?
Yeah, I'm a very compassionate person, would do about anything for anybody. I would try not to ever fall apart in front of anybody that was going through it. I wouldn't want to make them feel any worse by me not being able to handle it. I would try to give them comfort and things are going to be okay and that sort of thing. Even around the people that have passed away that I've been around, I've tried to, hold a position of strength, you know, that things are going to be okay and be positive, be a positive person around it.
And how have you ever had that? Do you feel like you have had that kind of, has there been somebody or some people for you that have been strong for you through your life in a way?
No.
Or consistent? Nope.
No.
You just, how'd you know how to do this then? Is it because you feel like you're missing it a bit?
Could be that, and it could be just my natural tendency.
Isn't it interesting, like sometimes, do you ever feel like sometimes the things that we're the best at, it's like the things that we can offer, but nobody can really offer us back the same thing, right?
Yeah.
In a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
Do you feel like your steadiness then is kind of, is that another gift that you notice in yourself, or have you noticed that I wonder how you feel about that. Have other people been drawn to you because of your steadiness? Do you just attract chaos then?
No, people I've worked with over the years and reported to me over the years have put that as part of their memories of working for me. On LinkedIn, for example, you know, where they put, you know, their memories of, steadfast, made me feel confident, you know, that kind of thing. So a lot of that was things that I would impart to my employees as well. So I just naturally started doing that, I believe. Maybe it's because it was the way I would have liked to have been treated and everything, but just felt that it was necessary to show that.
Mm. Okay, let's pause here. And also, Dad, I'm going to pause.